Welcome to episode 23, Island CT Podcast.
A podcast about science, nature, technology, and education. And we didn't fill it out again.
We didn't.
It's like we forget every time.
How about polio?
Oh, yeah. That's a great... I was like, science in general. I have so much science this one, but polio.
Polio.
Definitely polio this
great
time.
Great things happening.
Yeah.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick. And together we are the hosts of the Island CT podcast.
So we're going to be recording this on November 18th.
We are recording it.
We are, I should say.
It's late.
It's late.
But it's early for, it's late in the day for us. It's very late. It's, what time is it?
8 o'clock.
It's 10 after 8.
10 after 8.
We are usually winding down by now.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a day early. Because you have, well, maybe you'll talk about global connections a bit for future plans, because that's tomorrow. That's why we're having to do it a day early.
It is.
So
I could get started with
any administrative stuff?
I don't. Hold it. We have a whole new look.
I worked so. I slaved.
He slaved. He truly did. Our site looks awesome.
I think it looks awesome.
I think it does too. So Pat's been working at colors and setting up the site for the last week.
Yeah.
And it really...
It's got a new look.
It has a new look. And it just looks nice and fresh and
much more
clean.
Consistent from one page to the other. Except for the podcast page. So actually... By the time this goes out, this will probably be updated so that people will know, but I can show you this is what the podcast page will look like. Well, before it was really different. You know, it's not so much working at tweaking colors and stuff. I mean, that's the fun when you're done with something major, but it really takes no time.
Right.
The time is how to create a system where you can enter in data just quickly and just type in go and it just builds everything for you.
Right.
And we're very close.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the web pages are built automatically. And we've had updates to the site. It has kind of held me back a bit for getting some of our older blogs up and stuff. But, you know, I have been getting...
I think it looks really good. It just is a much fresher look. And
it's lighter colored.
Lighter colored. And I really appreciate that.
Any other administrative stuff?
Not
really.
No, I don't think there is any more.
Okay. Go on to blog entries.
Okay. So I could start with my blog entry.
Sure.
Since it's something that I worked on last week. So November 11th, we took our Avatar crew, our 12 students, up to Raleigh. And it was a day off school, so there were three teachers and a research assistant from Dr. Marchetti's lab, Carly Marino, who went up to the Science Museum with us. And while we're at the Science Museum, Carly talked to us about her research on phytoplankton, specifically diatoms. And she will be going to Antarctica in January. She's already packed up all of her research equipment, and it's on its way down to the ship. And they'll be loading onto a ship and sailing from South America, the tip of South America, down to the western part of Antarctica.
Her equipment is...
So her equipment had to be boxed and shipped so that...
But she'll be taking a plane, wouldn't she?
No, she's going to be... This is what shocked me. I asked, oh, how are you getting there, Carly? And I thought, oh, well, she's taking a plane, right?
Right, yeah.
No, she's taking a plane down to South America, and then they're taking the boat, and they're steaming across to Antarctica, the western part of Antarctica.
Wow.
So, and I'm like, hold it, Carly. Like, isn't that like the area of the ocean that they talk most about? Like, that's the roughest area where you have walls of water every once in a while. Like, I was thinking of 2 years before the mass. I was thinking of sure. other, you know, writing that you hear discussed where they have horrific water
sure.
Conditions.
Yeah, definitely.
It's on the tip of South America. Yep. So she's like, yeah, that's true.
So, wow.
Yeah. So she's going to be on a ship.
Did she say how long she's going to be on the boat just to get across?
I think, I could be misspeaking right now, but I think she said it would take about a week.
1 week.
To get to the research location.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, that's tough.
Yeah.
If you're spending.
I'm like.
How long is she spending down on doing her research?
She will be there for 3 weeks.
3 weeks. So that's like a week of travel, 3 weeks, and then a week of travel to get back.
Yeah.
You're spending almost half your time traveling.
Yeah. Which makes me think.
On the way back, at least you can work on your right. stuff. Maybe. I don't know.
Right. And on the way there, they're probably taking like their equipment out and making sure everything's going to work for the mission.
Oh, she's traveling with her equipment.
Yeah. So her equipment has been boxed and it's boxed like set up so that it's in crates mm-hmm. and she has everything. That right. she needs. So when she gets there, she has to be able to set it up and get everything working and ready to collect data when her time for data collection is green.
So do I understand right that it's going to be a little bit like when you went to New Zealand where she's going to get on the internet and
yeah.
she's going to write to you guys and then your kids will be able to ask her questions?
Right. Well, but... She was, you know, we were discussing that before yeah. and I said, yeah, I said, you know, she mentioned video conferencing. I said, I totally want a video conference with you. It'll be great.
Yeah.
We can totally do this. I said, but I'm warning you, Carly, you're on a ship. I don't know how many hours difference you are going to be from us.
Yeah.
So when we talk about this, yes, I'm in. I think it'll be great. And we'll have to see what your timing is. Because sometimes people lose sight that they're out in a research boat. Yeah. Yes, they are doing cool stuff. But if it's not during our school hours and you
and
only can
on
talk
shift,
to
maybe.
Us. Yeah. And she's on shift and you can only talk to us at 8 at night or 6 in the morning. Well, that takes a little bit more negotiation about getting kids to, you know.
Yeah. I also feel like, so technology and stuff and fancy stuff like video, that's all well and good. But the fact is, you have this incredible experience of having a video that took a while to set up,
mm-hmm.
and it's a short amount of time to can see it, and then it's done, and it's like, wow. And then it was work, right?
Right.
And it's going to be a while before you do it again, and maybe on that 1 week trip, it only happens once or twice.
Right.
On the other hand, you have, like, the way you had it was with a blog.
Right.
And then they could comment back and ask questions, which then you reply. You can fill out something every night. And then they
right.
see it. And it's continuous the entire time.
Right.
And it takes very little effort.
Right.
That, to me, even though you don't have the flash.
Right.
It's the fact that there's communication ongoing.
Going back and forth.
And kids that might be a bit shy, that they'll never get a chance in one-shot video.
Mm-hmm.
Get repeated chances to ask questions and stuff. And
right.
They do it on their own. They don't have to fight anybody else. They can just write up a little question and send it.
Right.
You know.
And I had some things like that I thought would be interesting. Also, there's different technology that we have right now, like Lino, where you have message boards
mm-hmm.
that you can post a question. So we could post a question for Carly. Carly can take a notepad, like it looks like a little post-it note sheet. She can take one and answer questions. So it doesn't even, like, it can be even less complicated than a blog. And she can also put pictures over on a bulletin board, but it's electronic one.
The simplest thing, you know, even being able to go back and forth by email.
Right.
It's the fact that you can have continuous communication.
Right.
That does not take a lot of work on her part.
Yes. And that's what I warned her about. I said, you know, your whole trip, the whole point of it is for you to collect research.
Exactly.
And I said, and you know, when you're communicating with us, it's a bonus. We love it. And yes, we're totally in. But your focus is this.
And
we don't know if something broke. And so that puts you on a, you know, you have to do your stuff in the next 48 hours because someone else has to fix their stuff. So they're going to make it happen for you. You know, so you have to go straight instead of having the breaks that you would normally have. So I was trying to have that discussion with her as we were planning and really, you know, share with her how important it is for us to be reasonable. Now, after having that discussion with her, she was all excited. She went back and talked to Dr. Marchetti, and he was just like, yeah, you're totally going to Skype. Yeah.
But, yeah, you know, but see, that's typical of a PI, right? Yes, you're going to do this and this and this. Oh, and you're going to do this and this and this. And by the way, it'll take you no time to just do this, right?
And so, like, there's this list. She sent me this email of all the things that he would like to see. And I'm like, that's great, but we don't know about, you know, communication with the ship, what kind of communication the ship has, if it's great, if it's on. Or if it's like, yeah, it's great. And oh my goodness, when I was there, it broke for the week. Yeah. You know? So anyway, so it'll be great. I know the students, Carly, having come and talked to them and answered just questions, any questions that they had about her research. And it was very interesting, the questions they had. They were very specific questions. Like,
this was when you guys were at the museum?
Right. Uh-huh. So when we're at the museum, one of the questions, the kids were like, phytoplankton, like algae, like, and I realized, oh, they have no idea. She's talking about really small things.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Carly, like, when you collect your samples, what do you need to do to see them?
Uh-huh.
I said, you know, what do you have to use? Can you just hold them up to the light and you can see them? She goes, no, I need a microscope. And the kids are like, got it.
She's doing, so those she's kids doing haven't really done small. The Fuse Forward collect. Well, you don't go to Fuse Forward. You go to the local river.
Right. We go to Bowling Creek. They've done the macroinvertebrates, but they're things they can see with their eyes.
Right. But there's also a lot of stuff there that you need a microscope for.
No, we don't use a microscope for that until later when we go into microbes. Yeah.
Okay.
So they know about it, but the connection just isn't there for them to really be like, oh, yeah.
I remember taking videos for you.
Yeah. So we put our oceans and that over to
the ocean stuff.
Yeah, the spring, which will work well with Carly because Carly would like to come into class and work with students.
So that'll be cool.
Yeah. Very nice person. She'll be great to work with. And I'm looking forward to working with her for the next year. So that's what I had for my blog entry this week.
I guess I can do mine, except didn't we talk about this last time? It feels like we're always talking about mine, and I always skip them, but this was using our new microscope.
No, you...
We didn't. Maybe I always
I
feel
don't
that
think
way
you
because
did.
I talked to you about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I don't think you did, because we had just gotten it.
So my blog entry is number 45, and as we speak, it's still up on the site, but it might be in the full list and be replaced by another one pretty soon, as we add new ones up. Right, because I'm going to have a new one coming up.
Right.
But I wrote about taking a drawing or maybe a diagram that you generate on your computer that's a drawing of a circuit that you want to put on a piece of copper.
Right.
And this is the situation. You're not sending away to have something made. You just want to do it real fast at home.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a prototype, right? You're testing things out, and then if it works, you'll have them made by Oshpark or something like that.
Right, right.
And the basic problem is, well, you can make stuff with ugly construction.
Mm-hmm.
But if you start having chips that have quite a few feet, I personally find it nice to cut the copper.
Right.
And then you just solder it down rather than ugly construction.
Right.
Regular dip chips have a 100 mil spacing between the feet. And, you know, that's, I can cut that. That's not really a problem. But getting this diagram done on graph paper precisely onto a piece of copper
mm-hmm.
is really tough.
Yeah.
And you don't have to get the whole diagram exactly precisely, because most things, it doesn't really matter how precise you get it.
Right.
But for those feet on the IC, they have to be precise in the sense that you can't have a décalage from one end to the other, because then if you match the feet at the top end, then the ones at the bottom won't, you know, there's no way you can solder them down on your traces.
Right.
And so when you go to do the transfer, if it was transferring some picture in art class, well, you'd put two pieces of paper up against a window with light shining behind it, and you look through the piece of paper you're drawing on and see the one underneath. But copper's opaque,
mm-hmm.
so you can't do that. So you can redo the drawing from scratch, you know, looking at yours, but using a ruler to try to do it precisely, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or there's this method that I just found, which is really cool. We took our USB microscope and this can be done with either drawing that was done on a computer or hand-drawn, and I like to do it on graph paper, just mm-hmm. doodling, making my circuits. And what I did is I scanned the graph paper,
mm-hmm.
and I brought it up in GIMP, and I took all the white from the paper and turned it transparent.
Mm-hmm.
And then I used this program called, I did talk about it a little bit last time, because I remember saying it's some program. Anyway, but I do remember the name now. It's PQIV, P-Q-I-V.
Mm-hmm.
And I put on the blog entry, what's the command to bring up the image so that you could see through it.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the image of your board with the copper board that you're looking at with the microscope,
mm-hmm.
and you have superimposed on it the image of your drawing, which is partially transparent, and then you take your hand and you trace onto the copper, looking at the computer screen.
Mm-hmm.
And what I need, the example circuit I used was one that I was making where I didn't need it to be super precise, which is nice because I was trying to do it fast.
Mm-hmm.
And even just going through it really fast, it worked really well.
Nice.
So the copper right now is sitting next to us. This is it right here, which, of course, with just audio, no one can see, but I have it in my hand. And I tinned it, and I made some vias, homemade ones. So that's going to be my next blog entry. I found a really cool way to make those. I haven't put any of the pieces on it. And that, I think, is all we're going to talk about. One last thing that's important. If this will only work if you're on your desktop, you can set up compositing. I didn't know exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard about that. I don't really know anything about it, but there's instructions for XFCE, how to turn it on, and it worked for me. Yeah, it's just something that has to be done for the transparency to work.
Very nice for small work and things that...
And prototyping.
And prototyping. So, yeah.
So I think this is all... This week, this podcast, we have so much science and working on the website so much.
Mm-hmm.
And... having so much great science come down the pipeline.
Oh, yeah. More than what we could cover this week.
Yeah. I really didn't get very much building done at home. Mm-hmm. Practically none. Plus, we had a no meet.
Right. We've been on the move a little more. So that's always a good thing.
Yeah. So So I think that's going to be all that we're going to talk about in terms of building and stuff. It's unusual, but...
Mm-hmm. So, we have a few things, a few
minor topics
that we have shared through the week, and I thought maybe we could start with those.
Okay.
So,
are these going to be all science?
Yeah. Did you want to...
Before we go into the science, I'll just make one mention.
Okay.
I used a program called Dia. Here's the web page for it. You can download it for Windows. Of course, I use it on Linux. And the lady that was doing the floor plan for our lab, because we just moved and she has to remake it for safety reasons, mm-hmm. she was trying to do it by hand, redrawing the lab with a ruler.
Oh my goodness.
I'm like, oh no. So I had this installed for making flowcharts.
Right.
It's at work, I'm using Debian 7 still. I had it already installed. I hadn't used it for a long time. And I'm showing Kelly as we talk, but you just, you know, take a square and you put it. It's like making a flowchart and you label it. And I was labeling things from, you know, bench.
If you're a teacher, this would be handy for making great floor plans of classes.
Exactly.
Without a lot of work. So you can place your desks wherever, and then you can write the names of the students or the desk number on it. The other thing, which is kind of cool, is just to make flowcharts for the students to fill in.
Check out this. You take the curved arrow,
mm-hmm.
right? Properties, you get rid of the arrow end, and you just make it a quarter of a turn. Then you make another arrow, but you make it a straight one. Make half of the 90-degree angle with it. Get rid of the arrow. And you've got basically the sign for a door. And then you make your room around it. Oops. Delete this.
Got it.
Make a square for your room. Oh, wait. Does this keep happening? What's happening to me? Anyway, you get the idea.
Yeah.
Only wants to go down for some reason. Anyway.
So this is it's your room. A great draw program with a lot of options for shapes and sizes. So if you're making graphic organizers or flowcharts for classes.
There. A room with the door.
Nice.
Anyway, nice. I mean, it was lightning fast. And mm-hmm. I wasn't sure it was going to be so fast, but and I'd never use it to make a floor plan.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so that's a small little find, really mm-hmm. handy little program.
Free.
Free, open mm-hmm. source.
Open source, yeah.
Dia. And I used it for making flowcharts for keeping track of what I was doing in programs that were getting a little bit too big. But this was just for making a floor plan. So that's the only non-science thing we're going to cover. Okay.
Okay.
So I guess we're diving in now.
Yes.
Like
so very
just
exciting.
Just one amazing story after another.
Yeah. I wanted to start with...
Do a big one first. Let me see.
I was
there
thinking,
it is.
Yeah,
this
I would like to start with polio. and eradicating polio, they're estimating that polio will be totally eradicated by 2019.
Or that's like a hope.
Oh, a hope, yeah.
I don't know if it's a prediction.
Yeah.
So this is the editorial out of the November 6th issue of Science.
Right.
And the week before, what prompted this was the week before, the background is that there's three types of poliovirus.
Mm-hmm.
Type 1, type 2, and type 3.
Right.
And do they call them serotypes like they do with the dengue, or I don't know. Anyway, there's three types.
Right.
And type 2, the week before, had been declared eradicated over the entire world.
Right.
Which is pretty amazing. Going from memory, if I remember correctly, one of the other types, type 3?
Type 3.
Hasn't been seen for right. 3 years. So in theory, there's a rule. The world governing body gets the data from the regional bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's been no cases for 3 years, they go through all the records meticulously and make sure nothing was missed, and then they can declare it free. And there's some region somewhere in the world that they haven't really gone through very carefully yet.
Mm-hmm.
But in theory, that one possibly is already eradicated. It just needs to be declared, and it's going to mm-hmm. take some work. And then there's type 1. And type 1 is still out there.
Right.
There was like several hundred cases last year.
Yep, 334 cases reported.
Okay. So.
Yep.
So, but it's possible that, I mean, they're going down over time.
Right.
And it's one of those things where it goes down and back up and back down.
Mm-hmm.
But on the schedule we're now, it's possible that we might be declared a type 1 free over the entire world by 2019.
Right, and that depends on if vaccines are given to areas that, you know, are yeah. still having these outbreaks. And
they're difficult areas to get to. There's been problems with, what is it? Is it Pakistan?
Yeah. Pakistan and Afghanistan.
In Afghanistan?
Yeah. So if they're like key areas where if they had vaccinations in there, they might have a...
Anyway, this is just so amazing cool.
I know, it is.
It would be the second major disease to be completely eradicated. And the thing that was cool is they were saying...
In our lifetime.
And because 1980, wasn't 1980 smallpox declared?
So, yeah.
So what I thought was really neat is they weren't saying... Okay, let's get gung-ho to get rid of this. They're like, okay, it looks like it's happening. And the significance for everybody doing the research is, if it's declared eradicated, we cannot afford to have this thing get loose again.
Right.
So
right
now, in preparation for 2019, everybody is going to have to start to inventory all of the stocks of mm-hmm. samples, not just of polio, but samples taken for other reasons from regions that had endemic polio transmission.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have to make two choices. One of two choices. Either you destroy your stock, or you move it to a very, very rigorously controlled containment environment, like a special lab of some kind or another, which is quite costly.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the samples are going to just be destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there's a reason to keep some.
Right.
Or maybe not. I mean, that's a debate that mm-hmm. some people have for smallpox and stuff. But and influenza for certain mm-hmm. types and stuff. There's no question. How much do you keep? But they're saying, you know, let's get ready for this now because... this is something that's going to be happening.
Yep. I loved seeing that, okay, this is the phase we're at. We're starting to set up that precedence for, you know, destruction or securing the samples that we do have. So that's exciting. My aunt had polio, and she actually got it when she was a child. And she, you know, it's something that I just never thought that we'd be this close.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's very cool for me to see.
So should we stick to...
diseases?
Virus?
Okay.
Well, vaccines?
Vaccines
is a big topic of yours.
How about we stick to vaccines? Okay. This is an article that, honestly, I didn't get to look at much. I heard a lot about it through Patrick, and it was interesting.
Is this the dengue?
The dengue.
Okay.
Vaccines. And I thought it was interesting that they weren't going for a vaccine that had 100% efficiency rate.
Okay, so let me explain a little bit what the point of this is.
Okay.
This is not, it's almost an editorial. Mm-hmm. They're making a case. They're saying, listen, we've always thought of vaccines as something we develop, and once you get it, then you can't get the disease.
Mm-hmm.
And they're basically saying, we've done that for many diseases, and the ones that are left, we've been trying for a long time, and that's just not going to be possible.
Okay.
Right? And so the case they're making is that it doesn't matter.
Okay.
It's not that it doesn't matter that you can't, it's not that you don't want a perfect vaccine. It's that there's so much benefit from getting a vaccine that's maybe just 40 to 50% effective. And it's so much benefit for two reasons. Number one, a hell of a lot of people are going to not get the disease.
Right.
Right? And compared to just having a prick when the, you balance that against what's the effect of the vaccine side effects and stuff. And you go for ones that have lower side effects for the population, right? So that's number one. Number two is the fact that your herd immunity goes up. But it's not just that. It's the overall effect on your healthcare. The herd immunity goes up for the disease that you're vaccinating against. The healthcare system gets burden removed from it, from all of those people that show up in your hospitals, which means those that do get it get better treatment, and those people that get other diseases get better treatments, and you can control epidemics better. And then number three, this is kind of a plus and a minus together, but the fact is, if you're going to go into a place and have a big vaccination campaign, and like in this case, it's associated, dengue is associated with the Anopheles mosquito.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the Anopheles? Maybe I'll tell. No, it's the Aedes mosquito.
Aedes.
Then, if you're going to be 40 to 60% effective, you want to hit that disease in many places at once, right? And so you're going to hit the mosquito.
Right.
Well, there's all sorts of other diseases that the Aedes mosquito also transmits. So you're going to reduce the burden on your health system also by having a knock-on effect of trying to control dengue by controlling the mosquito. So it's, you know, they're making a case, let's tackle the diseases from many aspects, including the vaccines. These vaccines that are, by the way, 40 to 60 or 70% effective only.
Right.
This is and so this specific one will be the very first dengue vaccine ever.
Wow.
And I'm starting to go from memory where I'm not quite as sure for the specifics, but if I remember correctly, The efficacy was around 60%, I think, overall,
mm-hmm.
but it depended on the group.
Yeah, it's...
Did you have it there? So the way I remember it is like...
Yeah, depended on the age group, so yeah. I'm getting different values depending on the age.
So generally, the way I remember is if kids over 9 years old
mm-hmm.
and adults, they get better protection.
Yeah, 66%.
Yeah. And also, if they've been exposed before, they get way higher protection.
Mm-hmm.
And the side effects also are lower in the older ones. So they're going to probably approve it if the trials go through and everything is mm-hmm. fine for only years 9 and older.
Right.
Wow. I mean, it's neat because there's never been a vaccine for dengue before.
No.
You know? I don't know. Do you know if dengue has other hosts? Because I assume the Aedes mosquito is biting all sorts of animals.
I don't know. I'm really not sure.
It was wild to look at the map they have in Science.
Right.
By the way, this is from the November 6th issue also.
Mm-hmm. But the map covers a huge portion of the Earth.
Yeah, they divide it up into areas that are where you have the Aedes mosquito. And in the U.S., that covers the southern half of Texas
mm-hmm.
and
Florida.
Florida. And looks like it might almost
Alabama.
Go up to where we are.
Mm-hmm.
But dengue shows up in the southern half of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
So shows up in
and it's just it's Mexico. Hits along the southern hemisphere.
Yeah, well, Africa looks. I mean, around the equator, there's more countries reporting dengue.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, it's kind of weird by country. There's some like Central African.
I bet
Republic
you it's
dozens.
Air. It's availability of water. And open water.
Oh, could be, yeah. Yeah.
Because you have India that's just loaded.
India's reporting cases.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, that could
where
be.
Where more arid countries like Australia.
Yeah.
They only have,
yeah.
you know, a small
amount.
Oh, in
Argentina. Isn't
Argentina.
That really dry?
Yeah.
This rain shadow. So. Anyway, so that was the point of the article. Is, you know, let's
nice.
Push forward with these vaccines because we can do a lot of good.
Exciting stuff.
Yeah.
Nice.
And dengue is a serious disease. I mean...
It is.
If you end up in the hospital with it, not everybody ends up with in the hospital, but if you end up in the hospital with it, you've got between a 0.1% to 1% chance of not making it out.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not us in general, but the average population that ends up in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, so that's the dengue one. That was also a cool one.
Mm-hmm.
What are you up for next?
So
we don't have like a major one. We have all
little
ones.
Yeah, we do. Okay, you choose. I've been choosing the last few, and I'm just removing them from our list as we talk so that...
I have two in a row, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
So it's... this is from the November 6th again. So we're moving...
Mm-hmm.
We're skipping to the first issue. It's about Maven.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a space probe that was sent out to Mars and arrived there about a year ago,
mm-hmm.
sometime late 2014, I think. And the whole point of it was for it to orbit around Mars, dipping down into the upper atmosphere and taking just all sorts of measurements. And all of the measurements we've had of the atmosphere of Mars from before that were in situ were from probes dropping down through, and they thought I mean, it's almost like an afterthought. Oh, we're going down to the surface of Mars. We're going to go through the atmosphere anyway. Let's see what's there as we go by flying.
Right,
by,
you right. Know.
This is different. This is, no, we're there for this specific purpose. And the way I understand it, there was one big question. There seems to be a lot of evidence that water was more plentiful on Mars than it is now. Now, yeah. It's there's water on the surface, but it's only as ice.
Mm-hmm.
And there might be liquid water underground, they're pretty sure.
Right.
But how liquid it is it? There's not much of it, certainly compared to what we think there was in the past. So where did they go? And the idea is, well, it escaped.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the gases reach escape velocity and off they go. And if there was so much liquid water on Mars before, then where are the... How... Mars had to be warmer.
Right.
Which means right. You needed gases to give it the greenhouse effect. And water itself is one of those, but, you know, CO2 also and stuff. So... MAVEN going down into the atmosphere was there to see what are the dynamics in the atmosphere, how is it affected when the sun has coronal mass ejections that hit it,
mm-hmm.
how is it affected by solar, and can we see what happens to the particles? And there's 4 papers just in Science, I think, and
amazing.
A whole bunch in geophysical letters, I think. I'm not sure. Maybe it's a different... I think probably it's a different magazine. I can't remember. I don't see. Oh, Geophysical Research Letters. That's what it is. I knew it was something different. I just couldn't remember why. Anyway, they have great stuff about what happens when a solar storm hits it. They've discovered auroras
mm-hmm.
on Mars. Which is really different from Earth, because there's not this strong magnetic field like on Earth that concentrates. So on Mars, it's like more diffuse.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it was neat.
It's interesting because if you think of the leaps and bounds of technology in just imaging mm-hmm. and what we can get from some of the imaging data from probes and that. And when you were talking, I brought up another one that was on another topic that you actually mentioned earlier this week, and that's the Cassini spacecraft that NASA has done as flyby missions of Saturn and getting images from the surface of Saturn and the flybys that they've just done as, I guess, the data we have up in front of us is from October 28th, and this has been published in November 18, 2015 of Science. Right. And, you know, same thing, they have a better understanding of the surface, they see subglacial oceans and things like that.
Enceladus is a moon of Saturn?
Yes, is a moon of Saturn. So it's all this information they're getting from probes flying by, and you just think of the incredible developments that have gone into imaging that allows to, you know, kind of tease that data out that was not available to us 5 to 10 years ago.
I'm trying to remember. So I'm seeing plumes. Is that the one that they were trying to fly through the plumes?
Yes.
And then on the way there, they realized, oh, wait, they might be way more rare than we thought or something.
Right. Exactly.
It's funny, we read those and it's like, oh, yeah, this is Cassini, that's Saturn, and so the moon is Enceladus. And then, like, a few months later, it's like, what's Enceladus again? It's a moon, right? I know that.
I know.
Saturn,
that's why
Mars,
I pulled it up. I'm like, oh, this is another
Mars,
topic
but...
that, you know, hit our car this week. And so
crazy.
I wanted to make sure and pull it up when you were mentioning yours.
Yeah.
But just fascinating stuff. And it'll be really interesting to see how all that data comes together in our understanding of just the geological features of all the planets that are within our solar system.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, pretty cool stuff.
So can I go back to MAVEN?
Sure. Sorry, I didn't mean to stop you.
Because MAVEN made the cover of Science,
mm-hmm.
and there was a blurb by the person who made the cover art
mm-hmm.
about how they did it.
Oh, neat.
And it reminded me so much of what a huge part of my work is,
mm-hmm.
Even though I don't do anything with planets. But basically, the cover shows Mars, just like as a picture, and then it has all these glow scale like particle tracks where the particles are shooting off of Mars in different directions, and some of them shooting off in RX, other ones in like curved turbulent trails and stuff. And the person describes that they received, I don't know, here they say, yeah, 8,052 text files. And each one had the trajectory of particles as X, Y, Z coordinates over time.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see. The shortest trajectory, they say, had 1,829 points. The longest, over 46,000 points. So they use a modeling program to make images. Let me see. I don't know. Cinema 4D, is that the modeling program, or?
Yeah.
3D modeling program, Cinema 4D to read the data. Yeah, so that's the program they use to make the pictures. And they wrote a Python script, basically, mm-hmm. to take all of those files and plot tracks out of them. And the point is, they're going for a visual effect.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see, who is this person? It's like the art, one of the art people for Science magazine. Valerie Altunian. Valerie mm-hmm. Altunian, science illustrator. Scientific illustrator. So they were saying, you know, the visualizations done for the magazine are very good at allowing you to look at, like, inside the articles, for example.
Right.
They're very good at allowing you to look at the data and get precise information. Now, how do you get the important facts to come out? But the visualization she has to do has to give a general impression that gives the overall picture. It's not important to get certain aspects out because it's a cover of a magazine. Right? She's still wanting to get information out to people,
mm-hmm.
but she wants to give the overview rather than this detail or this aspect plus this aspect
right.
plus this aspect, so you can see everything, right? Because you're not reading the article when you're looking at the cover. You're just looking at it and thinking about, oh, what does this mean, right?
Right.
So it's a different thing. So she has to come up with her own visualization. And, I mean, I do this all the time, right? I have just tables and tables of data from particles that I'm tracking in flows driven by cilia,
mm-hmm.
from airway cells that we culture. And they're being, they have different geometrical constraints
mm-hmm.
To the flows, and you do things to them that cause them to beat differently, maybe, or the fluid properties to change, and then you have to see how the particle speeds and directions change, and you get the images, and you get tons of tracks, and you write a program that takes out, okay, how well are they following the main track, what's the randomness, the distribution of different random velocities compared to the way the cilia beat and so on.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go through that data, just look at the numbers and have any idea of what's really happening. You have to visualize it somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And so, anyway, I felt a kinship to this.
I think it's really cool.
Person, and to the people writing the article, writing their own scripts. I mean, they, mm-hmm. this was not about their scripts, but you can, there's, they also show some of their visualizations that show different properties to the particles. Yep. Anyway, so I thought that was cool.
That is. So,
are we done with Maven?
Yep.
Do we have any more space stuff? I don't think so. Let's see. Nope. Okay. What next?
So I was thinking of moving over to Mount St. Helen.
Okay, geophysical visiting stuff.
So here's something really cool. So there's a new study showing the magma chambers below Mount St. Helen. And what I thought was most interesting about this article, and I'm trying to pinpoint it on my diagram.
Still November 6th issue or November 13th?
Oh, I'm not sure. I'll check.
Okay, you keep going. I'll look.
Okay. So in 2014, researchers stuck 2,500 seismometers in the ground on trails and logging roads around the volcano.
Oh, I remember.
And then they detonated 23 explosive shots so that they could get a better image of what was around underneath Mount St. Helen and maybe understand what the volcano better.
Ah, I just counted the dots in their picture. There's 23 different these circles.
Yeah, so they're the detonations or the explosions.
Yeah.
And 923 of those, or 920 of those seismeters were, or seismometers.
Seismometers?
Seismometers, thank you. I was like, man, that still sounds wrong. Seismometers were near the volcano's summit.
So no, I think those are a separate set.
Yeah, and they were put up there by the IMUSH group.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Yeah.
And so they're a separate set, but also very important for giving us the information about Mount St. Helens.
Well, I think the ones on top, weren't they to measure mini earthquakes in the volcano?
Yes.
And so you're getting information from within the volcano.
Right, exactly. But they were thinking it's because of the shape of the chambers underneath the volcano and having them be in two separate chambers that actually caused those the movement and
the big eruption of Mount St. Helens.
Right. So it caused the earthquakes, like the slight tremors that they heard before, or not they heard, they felt before the eruption.
1980 eruption.
Yeah.
Is that really that long ago?
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
Oh my gosh.
So, those were good years.
That's the same year polio was declared, not polio, smallpox was declared eradicated.
Yep.
See, I don't remember. I remember knowing that smallpox had been declared eradicated, but I don't remember it like in the news.
Right. No, either
Mount
do
St.
I.
Helens.
Yeah. It was all over the news. Yeah. So I just thought it was really interesting how...
So there was a third set. ...928 seismometers near the volcano summit. 75 seismometers, it's at the top here.
Oh, sorry.
In wider arcs around the volcano.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the idea is that the different sets, because of where they are and what they're recording, like the wider arc, I think they're just recording stuff from the entire Earth, the vibrations, can record to different depths.
Right.
I think that's...
Right. So...
I mean, it's definitely the biggest monitoring project ever put together in the
world. I don't know if you'd call them the array of...
Like telescopes, the mile.
Yeah, the mile.
The mile long array.
It's interesting because by having them set up, they could really see how those waves of energy were moving at different rates and get a better idea of the actual chambers.
So it goes slower when it goes through the magma, is that right?
So, yeah, it goes slower when it moves through the magma, which it always surprises me. I thought it would move faster through more of a liquid than a solid, but that's not the case at all.
Yeah, I don't know. Solids are denser.
Mm-hmm.
So stiff. Well, I think of faster through stiffer material.
Yeah, you're right. But faster through stiffer.
I'm not sure.
So.
And also, so they're reporting this, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they have so much data. It's like a minuscule amount of what they have, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so they show a picture with a single line across Mount St. Helens and up through Indian Haven, which is a bunch of extinct volcanoes.
Mm-hmm.
And they show a cross section that matches that line. So Mount St. Helens on one is Mount St. Helens in the cross section. Indian Haven is on.
Mm-hmm.
They have this theory about Mount Adams that it's close by, that there's a connection. But they haven't shown any of the data for that yet.
No, they haven't.
But they have the data. It just needs to be analyzed. And they just have this one cross section. And weren't they saying they thought that this giant magma chamber might be connecting all different volcanoes?
Yes, yes. That's the cool part, is it's that huge chamber that might be feeding Mount St. Helen and Indian Haven.
Yeah, and possibly Mount Adams.
And Mount Adams.
And possibly there's this other thing. See, it's big red. They call it the Southern Washington Cascade Conductor.
Right.
So if I remember correctly, that's something that they don't know if it's magma or not.
Mm-hmm.
All they know is that all the way from this area, way up north towards Mount Rainier, there's this long stretch where the underground, it's more electrically conductive than you'd expect.
Wow.
And they couldn't explain it. And one theory was, well, maybe you have seepage of salt water in there or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then it got crystallized or something.
Mm-hmm.
And when the water came out, you know, in some past era. And so, no, it's electric extra conductive because there's all these ions, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the new theory they're saying is, whoa, there's this magma chamber that we didn't had no idea about way, way deeper, and it's huge. And what if that conductor is actually just one long magma chamber?
Right.
And that's what's providing the conductivity, molten rock. So
yeah.
Maybe.
Maybe. And I also thought it was interesting about the precursor earthquakes showing the movement of the magma or indicating movement of magma from the larger chamber to the smaller chambers.
The earthquakes from before Mount St. Helens erupted. Yeah.
Right. So yeah. It was very interesting. I love the science behind it. The amount of...
How deep is that chamber? It's like 40 kilometers or something, they say.
Yeah. And I'm...
Mount Rainier is 75 kilometers away. That's really far.
Mm-hmm.
But then 40 kilometers... Yeah. Okay. No, I'm looking... Okay. A giant magma chamber between 5 and 12 kilometers below the surface and a second, even larger one between 12 and 40 kilometers down.
Yeah.
That's like an Olympic or international distance triathlon bike part, 40K.
Right.
Straight down.
Straight down.
Into
magma. Crazy. So,
there was another thing.
Oh.
Yeah, I just saw more slowly. Right. So, one reason they're thinking Mount St. Helens might be so explosive is if you have such a huge chamber, then you can get separation of the magma in there.
Mm-hmm.
And you get some parts that settle out and
right.
then they crystallize.
Crystallize.
Which means then that the top part becomes relatively lighter as it loses some. Mm-hmm. And then, so then that tends to try to push up harder.
Right.
And then it pushes up into the top chamber, and mm-hmm. then that pressure just goes up too high in that one, and it blows.
Right.
So, which sounds familiar.
Yeah.
And didn't we do like a podcast a while ago about some kind of a separation
yes, due to... We did. It was with looking at hot spots and looking at the movement of plumes. Up into hot spots at the surface of the earth.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep, mantle plumes. Okay. So you get the next one.
I get the next one.
You get to choose.
Let me find the articles again. Okay, so that was melting helms. Let me close that one. Let's see. Stay with geophysical stuff if we can.
Okay.
Before we move on to biology. It's mostly geophysical we have. Okay, well, we're about half physical and biological now. Mm-hmm. Or actually, I don't know what you have, but... So, geophysical, do you want to do real quick the Greenland one?
Okay.
You weren't particularly impressed with that.
I was not. I just have to take a moment to open it up. So you go ahead, and I will open in a second.
Yeah, I can do that quick. I mean, there was one thing, but so I did check the date.
And I'm interested to know what you have to say about it, because that one...
These are mostly from November 13th of Science. What I took away from it, the interesting thing I found was this idea that the glaciers on the west side of Greenland have been known for a long time to have been accelerating and losing their mass into the ocean. In particular, there's the Jacobshavn
glacier.
Anyway, that's one of the glaciers. So they had this big satellite data collection. Was it all satellite? I think it was.
Yes, it was.
But from many different agencies,
right?
Like six different agencies, all their satellites, and they did all these careful measurements, and they found out that actually there's another glacier that's just starting to speed up, and it's been speeding up for a long time. And what's unusual is it's on the east side, and it's the Northeast Greenland Ice Stream. And the glacier at the bottom of that one, I don't know if it's one or three. There's three glaciers at the bottom. But the Zakariai Istrum is either named for all three or for the biggest one. I don't know. That's just really increasing in speed.
Right.
And there's a section over a shelf where, for the first time, they've seen that the ice is no longer making contact with the ridge at the end of the shelf.
Right.
And behind that, there's a basin of water underneath. So as soon as that ice made no more contact, then warm water could get into the basin and then eat away at the glacier much further in.
Right.
I don't know how many years that's been going on for, but... they could tell that by telemetry. Interferometry. Because they would look at whether the ice was moving up and down. I thought this was kind of cool.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't, it's sitting on rock.
Right.
But if suddenly it starts to move up and down with the tides, it's like, oh, crap, it's lifted off.
Right.
And so I don't remember how many years ago that happened.
So the agencies involved in that were NASA, the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency and the Canadian Space Agency and three European agencies.
Okay.
So and six. This was 40 years of data.
Oh, did you see at the very end of the
That's what I was about to bring up. The acronym they came up with.
I know. I thought that was funny. Let me see.
The acronym is Oceans Melting Greenland, and it's OMG.
OMG study.
I know. And I was like, oh, that's bad. But fun.
But I love the idea. So they say they're going to deploy robot probes to measure seawater temperatures and stuff. We had a talk not too long about all this new science that's being made possible by the use of miniaturized electronics to make robots that then independently autonomously go out and make measurements, but not necessarily autonomously. They might be controlled.
Actually, there was just radio guidance. In one of our podcasts, we mentioned this one guy who came up with this whole system of releasing many small probes.
They were buoys.
Buoys, yeah. They were very small, though. Yeah. Nice. Yeah.
So, not tons to talk about the Greenland article, but it was, I don't know, I thought it was cool. They did mention something about, well, how it could have a huge effect on sea level rise with zero information there.
That's what bothered me about the articles, that they made a big, well, I thought they were, with the title on that, it was a big statement about sea level rise where they didn't have any information to really talk about that in a specific way.
I only have three articles left. Do you have others?
I have a few articles. There's two that I would like to talk about together, and it's about the size.
Okay, so wait a second.
Okay.
You're going into biology. There's the thorium one.
Okay.
You sent me that one.
I know, I didn't get to it.
Oh, though. You never get to it.
No, but we can go over it. I looked at it briefly before we started.
So I'll make it. I'll do it super fast then.
Okay. That sounds great.
It's something I'd never heard about. Supposedly, in the 1950s, there was a push, mostly. Actually, I don't know if it's mostly in the States, but it definitely did happen in the States, to use thorium as a nuclear fuel.
Right.
And then it was shelved for a number of reasons, because it was found, well, uranium and plutonium work so well.
And so then, thorium, I understand, is a byproduct of the...
Oh, well, go ahead.
Of the process? No, my mistake.
No. Thorium is actually more abundant, according to the article,
than uranium.
Than even uranium.
Okay,
and got of course, it. Way more than plutonium, because there is no plutonium on Earth except for the ones for the plutonium that we generate. It's not a, there's no natural plutonium. But there is definitely uranium. Just to skip ahead, not going into the details of what makes it possibly safer and easier to control. The way I understand it is thorium itself is not fissible. So you can't just generate, you know, take a, like if you take uranium and you take two clumps that are not undergoing, you know, a lot of radioactive fission, and you put them together, suddenly you've made this bigger surface to volume ratio. And you've got a lot more mass that's sending out, I can't remember if it's neutrons, but, you know, into neighboring mass. And so now it heats up more. And then,
so it works with the same
kind of... Well, thorium is not visible. So what you need to bombard it with something. And then it turns into uranium-233. And then that fissions.
Got it.
And so you... So if you're going to have a thorium plant, you have to bombard it with something. Because, and there is actually, I think, if I remember correctly, a plant right now that's doing that. But it's not a true thorium plant. What it is, it's a plant in India that's running on uranium-233. And their uranium-233 is made using thorium in a different plant. And they carted it over. So the plan in the future for that plant is to make some kind of a blanket of thorium around the area that's currently burning 233 and then convert it into just one that you keep putting thorium into it and it keeps. And then there's plans for a bigger one even that's going to burn at the same time plutonium, uranium, and thorium with 60%, if I remember correctly, of the energy coming from the thorium. Yeah, there's really different technology associated with it because you might have plants that are made out of liquid thorium salts or something. So unlike, you know, having these solid fuels, you're controlling a liquid. And actually you'd think that's scarier, but in a way it's safer because if anything goes wrong, you just drain it.
Got it. So that was my question. So how safe is the process?
Well, I mean, it's still so far away, right? Mm-hmm. So they're saying there's potential for it to be a lot safer. Mm-hmm. But I mean, all of these things, it seems to me, they seem safe until you have to do them. And then it's like, oh, there's all this stuff we didn't think about.
Exactly.
That we have to deal with. But, you know, it's really a cool idea to bring this back and try something different. And a lot of countries are going for it. China's going to build a plant. United States is doing some research. Belgium.
So one thing I just noticed that you didn't get to is your Python script.
I did.
Oh, did you? Oh,
that
that's
was
right.
The Maven.
Okay, sorry.
I downplayed the fact that it was Python because to me, you know, it doesn't matter what you write. It doesn't even matter to me. Actually, having it be a script is not a benefit because that means it's going to run slower than something that's compiled. But it's just the point that there's stuff that you just can't put in a spreadsheet and just plot. You know, you need to have functions that either they're going to have to be recursive or they're just too complicated to get the information out of the raw data that you have. That's just, you know, positions over time, for example, in three coordinates. I mean, it's cool that it's Python. I'm not into Python, but it's just that idea of getting all this data you can understand out of data that's raw.
Right.
Anyway, I think that finishes our thorium.
Yes, it does.
I'm really curious to see where that goes.
Yeah, I am too, actually. It'll be interesting.
I have
the body size.
Body size, that's one that you sent me also.
Right. So I dug into some geology ones. Actually, I'll go to the article. And it was an article, body size reduction in vertebrates following the end of the Devonian mass extinction. So I found this pretty interesting where they took all these fossils of organisms and they looked at size. And
they... This was mostly fish.
Yeah. Mostly fish. And they found that in the Devonian period that there is actually a trend to increase size.
Yep.
And then during the
Mississippian
period, the size actually went for a reduction of size.
Yeah.
And it was just interesting that, you know, now they're trying to think, okay, so what drove this size change? And they think it was stemming from biotic factors and long-term conditions, which suggest a relationship with climate change.
So I didn't read as much as you did about this, but mm-hmm. you want to hear my really simplistic from yeah. trying to just read it super fast? Because so the Devonian's older.
Right.
And there's this idea that when populations are established, if you happen to be born bigger than everybody else, then you kick them out of the way. Mm-hmm. Everybody's established. Suddenly
right.
you're bigger. You can kick them out of the way. So slowly body sizes increase, right?
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the Devonian, you had the, what do they call this thing? There was a big extinction event, mm-hmm. right? Around 360 million years ago. So there's this extinction. So suddenly, everybody's not established. Everybody's dead. And there's just a few people around left, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're big, there's no advantage. There's plenty of resources, right?
Right?
If you're small, you can reproduce really fast.
Right.
Take over areas where everybody's dead. And of your offsprings that are smaller, they go even more spreading out faster.
Right.
So there's an advantage to be smaller until the niches are filled. Not only that, but it's really long lived. Mm-hmm. Because once all of these small ones are established, the big ones can't get a foothold in.
Mm-hmm.
And so they actually get outcompeted. They die off.
Yeah.
And then once the whole everything is reestablished, you know, millions and millions, hundreds of millions of years later, or well, maybe not hundreds, tens of millions of years later, then everything's really encrusted. Then in a particular place,
mm-hmm.
one that slowly increases in size, because the resources are now limited, then it becomes beneficial because there's no benefit to radiating. Because if you're fastly moving into a new area, there's mm-hmm. already crowding there also. So having a high birth rate because you have a low size and quick growth rate because you have a small body size at adult is not beneficial. Anyway.
Right. No, no.
That was
when
my
you
super
were talking,
simplistic. I'm looking at the graph.
I rushed into another article.
Oh, did you?
Where I thought, no, no, it goes along with this one.
Yeah.
And I thought they mentioned specifically sharks.
Yeah.
And how shark body size, you know, went for evolution. Through evolution, they changed to a smaller body size over this time. And so that's why I was looking to see that it was mentioned, and I can't find it specifically, but I think the sharks were one where they show that marked decrease in body size. So just kind of cool that we have an animal. So I just thought it was interesting, and it's
so the Mississippi, boy, Mississippi, even that's way long before the dinosaurs.
Right.
That's even longer than that. We have to find out what that extinction event that I keep remembering at 250 million years ago. Like that latest time they look at is way even before that.
Mm-hmm.
It's like 320 million years ago. That's the youngest
mm-hmm.
time on their chart.
Right. So.
And I have to say, when I look at the graphs of the individual fishes and I look at their diagrams of fishes, my explanation doesn't seem like it's way over simplistic. Because I'm like, I don't recognize what I said looking at their stuff.
I know. I had to read through it and... You know.
The general trend matches.
Right.
Right?
The trend, yeah.
If you look at the average data body length, Devonian, it keeps creeping up.
Mm-hmm.
You get this, here they have it, Hangenberg event. So that mm-hmm. must be that mass extinction around 360 million
right.
years ago. And then it dropped. It starts to drop.
Mm-hmm.
In the Mississippian.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that goes way, way far back.
It does.
420 million years ago. Ooh, these are log scales for body length.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about huge changes.
Right.
From like just over 11 centimeters up to, this looks like 90 centimeters or so.
Yeah.
Oh, did you lose your power?
Yeah, I have to run. I forgot I wasn't plugged in, but I haven't lost it yet.
Oh, please, oh, please.
There. So I'm just going to do a bit of distance here. It won't be too long.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so that's kind of sums up our article on body size.
Is your Audacity still recording?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think we are coming to that time. I just want to look at our notes. There's some things I'm putting off till next time, so I've highlighted a bunch of things. But when I started to look at the time...
Ooh, we're over an hour and
yeah,
20 minutes.
So I thought this
Wait,
might...
Wait, you can't go on. There's one more.
Oh, okay.
You know on podcasts where they're like, they keep talking about the same thing over? And
yes.
They say it's like
oh,
the
yes.
bingo word.
CRISPR.
I have one. So what did you say?
CRISPR.
Yes.
I noticed it over your shoulder. I was like, what is that?
It
you found a CRISPR?
CRISPR. I don't think we can have a podcast for the rest of our lives without CRISPR coming up.
And it's CRISPR-Cas9.
It is Cas9 this time.
Yeah, I think I noticed that article.
It's more
but
about
I didn't
Cas9.
Dig into it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So when I looked at it, it talked about Cas9 being an important unit for it to have to be able to go in and focus on key spots in the DNA.
Well, yeah, so they were trying to measure how that happens.
Yeah.
It's not really like a new finding or anything. It's like Cas9 is a bacterial protein.
Right, it is.
And it's
RNA, right?
It's a protein, but it's guided by RNA.
RNA. Mm-hmm.
So in other words, Cas9, there's RNA that binds to it,
mm-hmm.
and then it holds on to that RNA and goes searching for DNA that matches
right.
that RNA.
So it keeps that base pair or whatever
held
section.
Together
yeah.
to it, yeah. Mm-hmm. And when it finds it, then it signals for something like CRISPR or whatever to cut the DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like, well, bacteria, you know, that's one circular piece of DNA. It's pretty small. Got some plasmids there. So you put that into a eukaryotic genome, which has several orders of magnitude larger DNA. How the hell does it find places? And they wanted to see exactly mechanically, how does it do this? How does it search, in quotes? And so they did some alterations to it so that it would be fluorescent, so they could track it
mm-hmm.
microscopically. And then they set it to target some sequences that were very common in mouse nuclei. And
right.
they put it in there, and basically they did some tracking of the of Cas9, and they found they had different rates of diffusion, 3D rates, depending on when they were in areas that had very high DNA content versus lower. And in both situations, they had two different modes, one that was fast and one was slow, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, the on-off rate was pretty fast. So it would bind to DNA, come off, bind to DNA, come off, and it would mm-hmm. just hang on too long. But if it's in an area with lots of DNA, its diffusion through the area was a lot slower because it keeps binding to stuff
mm-hmm.
to check it out. And actually, I couldn't get through all of it, but there was all sorts of... I mean, this is really a technology article to find out this basic science about how...
What makes it an efficient system.
What makes it an efficient system of searching.
Yeah.
This bacterial system used for biotechnology in a eukaryotic
right.
system that it was not designed originally to...
Right.
To handle.
Yeah. I did look at that article quickly, and then I forgot about it until I looked over your shoulder again.
Anyway, that's all I really have for it. There's
okay.
way more in this article. Cool.
Okay.
All sorts of fluorescent probe fiddling and combinations. And
so what are some future plans that you have?
Future plans. Well, I was going to ask you, the reason we're doing it a day early is because of global connections.
Mm-hmm.
Is that science-y or tech. So that's nothing to do with science.
No.
Or even nature.
It's more of a school festival.
Festival.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Culturally based.
Okay. Well, we're not. It's just stupid.
That's not true.
That's not true. We like everything.
Yeah.
Off topic.
Okay.
Moving on.
To future plans.
Yeah. So I'm still dealing with the problems with the driver, but I really haven't worked at it for our ARDIF transmitter.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to get back to that as soon as the website is kind of getting running a little bit better.
Yep. This weekend, I might download Open Orienteering.
I was just about to put that on the technical side, Open Orienteering Mapper.
So that's my goal. And I also want to email Ian, who has an app that he said works really well with geosynchronized maps.
So georeferenced.
Georeferenced. That's what I meant to say. Georeferenced maps.
And I have to send you some georeferenced maps of the area.
So that we can use it
for
Falls
your
Lake.
Tablet.
Yeah.
You can test
that's
out.
What I'm hoping that it'll work for the with the tablet. So when we go placing flags,
you remembered.
We have it as a backup.
I see on future plan you wrote down Windows and VirtualBox. So
yes.
I still have to do that.
Yeah, and the kids at school have, instead of writing a grant for the robot, they want to get a drone.
They want a drone.
Which I think
drones
is
are
so much fun.
Cool. You can do so much with them.
And so then there are two girls that want to write the grant, and they got really excited about a drone. One went home and told her father, and she was all excited, and she starts telling him. And, you know, of course, they were excited about a drone, and it's a Donors Choose project where if the kids write the grant, it's student-initiated, they'll actually give us half the funding. So very cool, but it has to come for the kids, right? Mm-hmm. So they go home, they tell their dad, and their dad's like, well, let me look at the model. So he looks up the model, you know, and of course they just looked at it at lunch. And he goes, you can't program that. No, you really can't. There's really very little programming with that. And the girl comes at school today, and she gets so emotional when she's telling me that we have to go out in the hall, so I calm her down. Because she really thought the drone was a good idea, but her father told her there's no programming involved. So I said she could still write the grant because it goes on student passion, and now we just have to make the educational connection that you're going to use to have people invest in your grant. And she's like, okay, I'm going to go home and tell my dad tonight.
Or tell him that he should find a drone.
Yeah, because he had this other idea that you shouldn't do that. You should 3D print a drone and then
make
a Raspberry Pi, program a Raspberry Pi to run it. I'm like, oh my goodness, that'd be like a 2-year project for us.
There's one guy that I listen to, he says he has this something like $30,000 CNC machine, I think it is, or something. And the reason is that his son built it for him, and it took him a year to build over 1 year of college in some engineering college, and that's what the tuition was. It's like, I'm thinking, yeah, put together a Raspberry Pi, hook up the... And by that time, you've graduated from MIT.
I know. That's why I'm like, this is a little bit beyond.
So, but seriously, though, you know one of the things that when I started to hear about drones that I thought would be really cool? When we took ornithology way back, you'd hear about all the stratification of the birds, and especially the warblers, and there's all those that live higher in the canopy, and that's their environment. And they just never come down.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to love doing the just the call recognition and stuff.
Right.
And you start to, when you get into it, it's just amazing to hear all these bird calls and to be like, okay, so that's a common yellow throat and that's American chipping and blah, blah, blah. And then there's these ones that are way up in the trees, up high, the warblers, that you just never see.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could have a drone go up there, and you'd need to design it so it can just rest on someplace with its camera.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you pick a spot. Maybe it could have a hook. So it can hook. Yeah, if it had a hook straight up, right? So it flies up, and then it finds itself a spot where it can see onto an area where the birds tend to go, and it just hooks itself up so it doesn't have to make any noise or use up any battery except for the electronics and driving the camera sensor.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sits there and it watches. And being able to get images
right.
of birds that you just never see.
See, that's what I told her. I said, we have no idea what's going on up in the trees.
Yeah.
And I think we could write a wonderful ecology grant
sure.
to go along with that.
Yeah.
And I said, and you go back home and tell your father that ecologists use it all the time, and we use them for protecting our environment, for keeping those elephants under control.
Think about this. You know how they have the time-lapse photography of plants growing?
Oh, yeah.
Imagine getting an how image beautiful. Of the very tip of the tree.
Yeah.
You never see it from way up there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Maybe it would look just the same.
It
and
might.
Maybe it'd be hard to match up the pictures. I don't
right.
know.
Right. But over time, if you had it geo-reference so that it was going
even,
to the
I think it would have
same
to be
place.
So precise that geo-reference wouldn't even be useful.
Yeah, that's
you
true.
Know, you just take a picture from close-up of what you think is a particular,
mm-hmm.
you know, you don't pick the huge tree where you can't see the top. And then when you get the pictures back, you try to take it always from the same angle and the same
right.
distance. And then you just match every picture from every 3 days or once a week.
Mm-hmm.
And scale it as best you can to match it the same as the other. And then you make a movie from all of those.
It would be beautiful.
And
yeah.
So.
That would be incredible. Especially a seasonal change.
Yeah.
You know, through a year.
Yeah.
It'd be nice.
And you could go place things up high.
Right.
With your drone. Like you could put a bird feeder up there. Then you would.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there's some things. I'll have to tell her all your ideas. She'll be very excited so she can go back and tell her father. So I think it is time for us to wrap up.
I think so.
So.
Oh, that's me. Okay, got it. I have to say, this was so long. 30 minutes. Okay. Thank you for listening to the Island CT podcast.
Make sure you check out our blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.